available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and a warm welcome from me, Ashley Haywood, to this week's Outlook, which is being recorded on Wednesday the 10th of December 2025. Today we're going to continue our journey around all the Warwickshire villages and hear more about our canine heroes, as well as a man who thought he could fly. There's a short update on the redevelopment of Spon End in Coventry, and on a seasonal note, we have a consideration of the novel A Christmas Carol, and some feedback from the recent winter warmer here at the Hub. All of this, plus the sports news, your postbag, and an update from the Hub. Firstly, however, we have today's local news read by Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
The City Council's finance chiefs are happy the authority is heading in the right direction, following an assessment which found that 15 of the 17 standards checked each year were on track. The Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy report provides guidance for good and sustainable financial management. Phil Helm, the Council's Head of Finance, said the report showed things were moving in a strong and positive direction. But he added that in certain areas Coventry did not fare well against other councils. He told a recent meeting of the Finance and Corporate Services Scrutiny Board that there were two areas where there was work to do. One of these was around financial sustainability in relation to how much the Council pays out for children's placements. He explained, "As a council, we don't compare favourably to other local authorities in what it costs us to deliver care for our looked-after children. Quite a lot has happened in Coventry over the last 2 or 3 years, not least the savings that the council approved in February 2025. That is not reflected in the latest data, and similarly, work around foster care contracts and around building new children's homes are still working their way through the system." Councillor Christine Thompson said the council was in a difficult place. She pointed out, "Part of the issue is the fact that we are having to rely on a broken market with external providers, and that as an authority with a statutory requirement to look after the children, we are stuck between a rock and a hard place. We have shown fiscal prudence and foresight by actually developing things." Councillor Richard Brown, the portfolio holder for Strategic Finance and Resources, added, "It is good to see that we are working in the right direction, and overall I'm pleased with the direction of travel. This is not just about driving the costs down, though. This is about finding the right balance so that what we do is the right thing for our children, because that, to me, is the most important thing."
Millions of pensioners are being advised to watch out for a second payment arriving in December. The DWP Christmas bonus is paid on top of the state pension. It is intended to provide that bit of extra help with expenses over the busy festive period. The bonus is worth £10 and should land in bank accounts during December, ahead of Christmas. The money will arrive automatically, so there's no need for anyone to make an application. Therefore, pensioners should monitor their bank statements so they know when they've received the additional payment. Millions of retirees are also receiving winter fuel payment worth up to £300. These are being distributed during November and December, so this money may already have arrived for many. The £10 Christmas bonus is designed to help more vulnerable groups, also including people with disabilities and health conditions. Those who receive PIP, Disability Living Allowance and Attendance Allowance are eligible. Campaigners have urged for the bonus to be increased in amount in order to make a genuine difference. The government says the Christmas bonus is a one-off, tax-free £10 payment made before Christmas, paid to people who get certain benefits in the qualifying week. And this week is normally the first full week of December, so look out.
Buildings at Coventry Airport look set to be bulldozed as a huge new planning application is submitted for the site. The Planning Committee at Warwick District Council will consider the application this week. The application seeks approval to develop a battery manufacturing facility. The Reserve Matters application includes the demolition of existing structures and the formation of a main spine road with car parking, access and associated works. It comes after it was confirmed that Coventry Airport is set to close next year. Outline permission was approved in March 2022 for the development of a battery manufacturing facility, a gigafactory, known as Green Power Park. This next stage of the application seeks permission to bring forward the development. The Planning Committee is being advised to approve the application for the site in Baggington, which sits on the border of Coventry and Warwick District. The plan has proved divisive so far. Baggington and Bubbenhall Parish Council have both objected to this most recent application, questioning the overall safety of a battery gigafactory that is not in an isolated and controlled area with its own road and rail infrastructure. Baggington Parish Council said, "It is within a highly populated area that is adjacent to a heavily used national road network that would be completely closed down in the event of an incident at the gigafactory, placing thousands of lives in danger." But Coventry City Council has not raised any objections, although it did note discrepancies in the noise report. Ward Councillor Josh Payne said he was minded, on balance, to support the application. A report prepared for the Planning Committee at Warwick District Council recommends approval. It states, "The proposed works contained within this application are consistent with parameters for the development that were established at outline stage. The details provided for the earthworks, strategic drainage features, primary substation and the main spine road are all considered acceptable."
Coventry welcomed the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, to the city levelled by the Luftwaffe in the Second World War. Mr. Steinmeier's state visit to the UK was the first by a German leader for 27 years. He, his wife and Elke Budenbender toured the new cathedral, which was completed in 1962, and joined a prayer service highlighting the ministry's commitment to peace and reconciliation. In a symbolic ceremony, a German wreath was laid by the couple at the cathedral ruins, which was famously destroyed during an air raid 85 years ago. The Duke of Kent was also in attendance. More than 500 people were killed and thousands of homes destroyed when the German Luftwaffe bombed the city during the Blitz of November 14, 1940. The couple were in the UK from Wednesday last week when they were greeted at Heathrow Airport by the Prince and Princess of Wales before a ceremonial welcome at Windsor and a state banquet. On Thursday morning, the German President laid flowers at the tomb of the late Queen Elizabeth II before joining the King and Queen for a big help-out reception to showcase the impact volunteering can have on communities. During his three-day visit, he also took in Downing Street for talks with Keir Starmer, as well as a meeting of UK and German business leaders.
Pet owners should be aware of the signs of a respiratory infection in dogs that may cause a hacking cough. The highly contagious illness is not typically serious, but it can lead to pneumonia in more vulnerable dogs in very severe cases. The illness of focus is kennel cough, the general name given to bronchitis in dogs. Like chest infections in humans, various bacteria and viruses can trigger this illness, which primarily affects the respiratory system. Beyond a clear cough, experts at Blue Cross also suggest these bugs can cause a runny nose, eye discharge or sneezing, though dogs should still retain their appetite. The most obvious symptom of kennel cough is a forceful hacking cough, which will often sound like your dog has something stuck in their throat. The cough can be dry and hoarse or productive, in which case it can be followed by a gag, swallowing motion or the production of mucus. It is distant from a cough-like sound known as reverse sneezing, which is common in certain breeds and is triggered by irritation in the throat. Most cases of kennel cough do not require treatment, and dogs often recover within 10 to 14 days. However, puppies, senior dogs, or those with pre-existing health conditions may be at higher risk for more severe symptoms. Further guidance from the People's Dispensary for Sick Animals says, there are many different conditions that can cause coughing, so it's a good idea to have your vet check. To have your dog checked by your vet if they have a severe cough or have been coughing for more than a few days. When visiting your vet, make them aware that your dog has been coughing and wait outside until you are called to prevent spreading kennel cough to other dogs in the waiting room. Vaccination is the most effective way to prevent the worst symptoms of kennel cough and is particularly valuable if your pet spends a lot of time with other dogs or in kennels, and these are usually administered every year. Although humans may technically contract kennel cough, this is exceptionally rare and most likely to occur among people with already compromised immune systems. Symptoms may similarly include a persistent cough, fever and a sore throat, among others. Always consult your vet.
And after some kennel cough, we're now at Ducoughton Court. When the Throckmorton family announced in June that they'd be reclaiming the management of Coughton Court from the National Trust, members expressed their disappointment at losing free access to the popular Warwickshire attraction. However, it has now been disclosed that the Tudor Country House will be joining Historic Houses, meaning those who subscribe to that £68 a year membership scheme will be able to avoid the entry fee and explore the house, its treasures, gardens and surrounding countryside walks. Coughton Court was constructed by Sir Robert Throckmorton in 1409. The Throckmortons have maintained a 300-year residency and management lease since the estate was gifted in 1946 to the National Trust. It is currently closed for the winter, with plans to reopen under the family's day-to-day management in March 2026. While an entry fee is required to tour the house at Coughton Court, the Throckmorton family has announced that the stable yard will be freely accessible to everyone in the community, featuring a revamped cafe, an estate shop stocked with local products and gifts, a charity bookshop and a play area for children. A Historic House membership provides access to Coughton Court as well as other cherished destinations, including West Midlands favourites such as Charterhouse in Coventry, Hartlebury Castle in Worcestershire, Harvington Hall near Kidderminster and many more. James Probert, Director of Marketing and Development at Historic Houses, chimed in. It's fantastic to welcome Coughton Court to the Historic Houses Member Access Scheme. They're now one of many independent heritage attractions that our members can visit for free in the Midlands and of all around the country when they show their card.
We often think of graffiti as quite modern, the street art of urban New York City that emerged alongside other subcultures like breakdancing or hip-hop. But people have been writing and drawing on walls pretty much since the dawn of humanity. In Coventry, the concept of graffiti was taken over by the infamous Smile Tagger, who sprayed his admittedly cheery but nonetheless illegal vandalism all over the city shortly after the pandemic. But some etchings have been found on walls of Coventry houses and shared online recently, and have shed a new light on graffiti in our city. The houses in question are in Hillfields. The drawings are striking, as it is fairly obvious they are historic, probably scratched in the brickwork by young occupants sometime during the last century. It is thought the houses in question have their origins at the beginning of the last century. These illustrations appear to be airplanes, potentially etched by kids who witnessed aviation for the first time ever and were enthralled enough to capture them in the only way they could. At the time, carefully inscribing what they saw above their heads, maybe using some sort of pocket knife, possibly got them a clout round the ear from a parent, or a stern telling off from a nearby grown-up. but the mere passing of time has transformed them from mischievous scribbles that maybe earned the artist a sore bottom or an early night into the fascinating capturing of a moment that might have been filled with wonder, awe, or even fear. The images were located and then shared online by Scott Duffin, a Coventrian with a huge passion for all things history, especially Coventry-related. As you head down Ramby Road, halfway on the right-hand side from Swan Lane, we discover a large collection of World War I biplanes etched into the walls of two of the properties. These were likely done by youngsters of the time after watching them take off from the nearby airbase, which was located in Radford. A biplane is a fixed-wing aircraft with two main wings stacked one above the other. This design was common in early aviation, including the first powered flight, the Wright Flyer, due to its strong structure. If this theory is true, and children drew the planes having seen them taking off at the airfield, the drawings must date back over 100 years. Radford Airfield was a stretch of land built from around 1916 by famous car manufacturer Daimler Motor Company, who used it for their foray into aviation.
For years, it was the Coca-Cola truck that made people feel it was truly time for Christmas. But this year, if it's not the McDonald's socks, it's arguably been taken over by another festive vehicle, Christmas tractors. The biggest local event is undoubtedly the beloved Sheepy Ploughing Association Christmas Tractor Run that will take place this weekend, Friday the 12th and Saturday the 13th of December. On the Friday, there'll be a procession around Atherston and North Warwickshire, while on Saturday, it will be the turn of Nuneaton, Bedworth and Coventry. It's quite a spectacle, with more than 50 tractors kitted out in festive decorations all on the Coventry Ring Road, before heading to Holbrook's and then out to Bedworth. But this isn't the only Christmas tractor run in town, with festive events taking place throughout the county. For example, Southam. Funds are being raised for Galanos House in Southam. Their tractor run will take place on Saturday the 20th of December, and organisers have said, add us to your diary and it'll be a night you won't want to miss. The route hasn't yet been fully confirmed, but in the past it's visited Harbury, Long Itchington, Napton and Bishop's Itchington, starting off at Dallas Burston Polo Ground from 4 p.m. on that Saturday, with tractors leaving at 6. Another is the Warwickshire Young Farmers, who will return with their Christmas tractor run on Tuesday the 16th of December. They start off at Stoneleigh Park before heading to Cubbington, Lillington, Leamington Spa, Warwick, Leekwoughton, Kenilworth, Burton Green, Nailcote, Catcham's Corner and Balsall, finishing up at Birkswell and Balsall Rugby Football Club. This year, this tractor run is raising funds for Breast Cancer Now, for the Thomas Page Foundation and for the Warwickshire Federation of Young Farmers Clubs. A spokesman said, get ready for a night of twinkling tractors, Christmas spirit and community fun, all whilst supporting charities close to our hearts.
A Coventry community charity that works year-round to tackle food bank stigma will ensure struggling residents can enjoy all the trappings of a full Christmas dinner in their own homes. Urban Goodies CIC, based at the Haggard Community Space in Willenhall, has spent the past 4 years delivering Christmas dinner hampers, complete with meat, vegetables and all the trimmings. The packages even include presents for children and parents, as well as sweets and goodies to top it all off with that extra special Christmassy feel. But the charity runs much deeper than just helping people over the Christmas period. Urban Goodies is the brainchild of Claire Allington Dixon. She said the project was created to support people who might never have access a traditional food bank, while putting a firm emphasis on compassion. One of the reasons we started this is down to the stigma and shame many feel using food banks and hubs, and the fact so many live nowhere near an accessible one, she said. Urban Goodies was established in 2021, and delivers food parcels weekly to members' doors, using surplus food that would otherwise go to waste, alongside items the charity purchases itself. Nationally, an estimated 8.4 million people in the UK struggle to get enough to eat, while around 12 million tonnes of food is wasted each year. As well as food deliveries, the charity runs a Pamper project, which began as a response to period poverty and has since developed into tailored parcels of toiletries and essentials. Urban Goodies also hosts weekly cookery classes every Tuesday from 12 noon to 2 p.m, showing members and local residents how to cook affordable meals from scratch. The sessions include live cooking demonstrations and a free meal at the end. In Coventry, our mission is about changing how the local food system works, Claire said. We want people to access, enjoy and make choices about food in ways that feel positive. We rent space at the Haggard for our fridges and classes, but we need larger premises, she said. The need is massive and it's only increasing. The charity will host a Christmas fair on the 16th of December from 12 till 2 p.m. at the Haggard to raise much needed funds. There will be food, including chicken and stuffing batches, games, a rummage sale and a tombola.
A famous Coventry hotel has been hosting celebrities in the semi-final of a popular TV cooking show. The Celebrity MasterChef semi-finals took place on Monday the 8th of December, with the contestants embarking on a medieval cooking challenge at Coombe Abbey Hotel. The historic venue has hosted medieval banquets since 1971, immersing guests in the year 1539, when the tranquility of the abbey, which dates back to 1150, was shattered by the dissolution of the monasteries. The abbey would later become the home of royalty when Princess Elizabeth, daughter of James I, stayed at Coombe in the 17th century. One of the hotel's grand feature bedchambers is named after the princess, who was also linked to the gunpowder plot of 1605, when conspirators planned to kidnap her and place her on the throne as a puppet queen before they were foiled. The property was acquired by the Craven family in 1622 and it remained in their hands for around 300 years, during which time the gardens were transformed by Capability Brown into the stunning grounds that remain available and open today. It's celebrating 30 years since it was converted to a hotel in 1995, and this week the celebrities had to prepare a feast for 80 medieval enthusiasts at the former Cistercian monastery. Working in teams, they had 3 hours to create a lavish spread featuring meat, fish and vegetarian mains, plus a dessert, using traditional ingredients such as venison, pork, trout, cod, root vegetables, pearl barley and dark ales. Judges Grace Dent and John Turode tasted the dishes, with John keeping the busy kitchen running smoothly. The episode was aired on BBC One at 9 p.m. last Monday, the 8th, and is now available on BBC iPlayer. Ron Terry, Group Operations Director at No Ordinary Hospitality, which operates Coombe Abbey Hotel, said, "It was great fun hosting Celebrity MasterChef at Coombe Abbey, and even better that this episode shines a spotlight on one of our best-loved dining traditions at the hotel."
A pub is offering the UK's priciest draft beer at a staggering £75 per pint. Yabard is peddling the incredibly potent 21% ABV American Blessed Stout in third of a pint glasses due to its strength. The tasting room in Stratford-upon-Avon charges customers £25 for a 189ml glass, equivalent to £75 a pint. Owner Dave Moore claims his keg is one of only two outside the United States, and just 100 patrons will have the opportunity to savour a sip. He stated, "I think it could definitely be one of, or even, Britain's most expensive stout. It's a very small batch beer, and the amount of work that has gone into this beer is out of this world. The beer would take around a year to make, and then the aging is 33 months. It's aged in Heaven Hill Bourbon and Russell Reserve barrels with coconut and vanilla. One of my wholesalers sourced some bottles of Blessed, and once we tasted it, we said, "This is one of the best stouts we've ever had." The extensive aging imparts the drink with a robust Bourbon aroma and afternotes of dark chocolate. Due to its high alcohol content, 5 times stronger than most stouts, Dave says drinkers will be limited on how much they can consume. He said we're only selling it in the third pints because it's not for everyone. It delivers a smooth, warming flavour with a dense texture and a subtle, spicy note. Dave continued, "I can understand the price might raise an eyebrow, but it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's an experience to savour one of the rarest beers in the world. A very nice glass of wine might set you back £20 or £25. To me, this is another level of quality, a niche product, and customers will get a Blessed glass to keep. It's the best stout, possibly the best beer I've ever tasted. The complexity of the flavours is quite extraordinary."
The Coventry Police Museum is a branch of the West Midlands Police Museum based in Birmingham. The Coventry Museum is based in the Council House and is open every Thursday and Friday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It first opened in 1957 at Little Park Street, now the location of Coventry Central Police Station. It closed in 2020, but West Midlands Police Museum supported a pop-up museum as part of Coventry's UK City of Culture celebrations. Now the museum has found a new permanent home at the Coventry Council House. Entry to the museum is free and walk-in visits are welcome. There are collections of historic helmets and badges, police equipment across the ages, historic artefacts and confiscated property, perhaps including some stout. There is a roll of honour of officers serving in the city and interactive displays of crime scene and forensic investigations. There are displays about the history of law enforcement in the city. The museum is staffed by a team of dedicated volunteers eager to answer your questions and share their stories about policing in Coventry.
Meet Britain's finest prison pooch, a tennis ball obsessed black Labrador capable of detecting drugs in any lineup. 3.5-year-old Eric was crowned champion at His Majesty's Prison's dog trial finals earlier this year. He and his handler Charlie Mullard took place in a series of trials and triumphed over more than 200 other teams. Over 2 days in Warwickshire, Eric had to successfully identify drugs being carried by individuals in a lineup, followed by another challenge where he needed to ignore tempting distractions while locating drugs hidden in 16 different containers. In the final section, Eric worked with Charlie to detect as many drugs as possible on a rack filled with overalls in merely 1 minute and 30 seconds. Teams making incorrect identifications or failing to follow proper procedure would face penalties before their final score was revealed. When Charlie discovered they'd won all 3 categories, operational search, scent recognition, and search, the handler said, "I just wanted to get to the finals. If I came 8th, I could still say I was in the top 8 in the country. I'd have been over the moon with that. I knew Eric was very capable, but there were some very strong dogs that were competing as well, so I am very, very proud." Eric typically works at His Majesty's Prison, Pentonville, and resides with Charlie in Harlow, North London. The dog handler, with 8 years' experience, described Eric as good as gold and a lover of his tennis balls when he's off duty at home. However, when it comes to work, Eric is all business. A lot of our work is searching officers, staff, contractors, legal visitors and social visitors, family members of prisoners and things like that. At work, he's a very, very calm dog. Not much fazes him. He's very relaxed.
Outlook News.
And a big thank you to our newsreaders, Peter and Elaine. Now, sunrise is now at 7:55 a.m. and sunset at 3:52. We're nearly at the shortest day of the year, aren't we? A reminder, next week, the 17th, that'll be our last Outlook before Christmas. We'll have a two-week break and then we're back on January the 7th. Now, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Rowan. There's a lot of seasonal events that are taking place and she's going to tell us about them.
Absolutely. From the 15th to the 21st of December, there are lots of events happening across the region. In classical music, G4 Christmas programme includes traditional carols and modern festive hits. This is on Tuesday, the 16th of December at Coventry Cathedral. Britain's Ceremonia Carols, featuring Cecily Bear on the harp and the Calendar Girls, and the Cathedral Girls Choir, is happening on the 18th of December. on theatre times now, a Christmas Carol, Paul Nolan's one-man production of Dickens' timeless story of redemption, compassion, social responsibility, and the importance of family and community. This is on from the 17th of December to the 21st at Charterhouse Coventry. You can book your tickets on the number 02475 107 567. In children's theatre now, The Gingerbread Boy. A brand new Christmas story about friendship and celebrating our differences. This is on at the Albany Theatre from the 20th to the 24th of December. You can book your tickets now on 02476 998964. These box office lines are open from Monday to Saturday, 10:30 till 1:30. In terms of pantomimes, we've got loads of pantos across the region, including Goldilocks and the Three Bears, which is on at the Priory Theatre in Kenilworth. If you want to book tickets, there is a number 0333 666 3366. These lines are open from Monday to Friday, 9 till 7 p.m. and Saturday, 9 till 5. There is also Sleeping Beauty on at the Belgrave that opened on the 19th of November to rave reviews across the county. This closes on the 3rd of January and you can book your tickets online on the number 02476 553055. In terms of light entertainment, The Snowman with Live Orchestra, a screening with Raymond Briggs Festival Classic with live orchestra and solo from the Cathedral's choristers. This is on the Saturday, the 20th of December at Coventry Cathedral.
That's lovely. Thank you, Rowan. Plenty to see. Yes, I'm going to two of the pantomimes. Oh, yes, I am. Now, I'm delighted to say Hugh's here for an update from the Hub.
I think we should definitely suggest to the Cathedral next year that they should employ the Calendar Girls.
Absolutely.
I think that
yes.
would be yes. I think that would be an yeah. excellent idea, and definitely we'll get a full house.
Yeah.
it's amazing what you could do with strategically placed holly and Christmas puddings,
amazing,
I'm sure.
Yes.
So this week we're in the we're sort of winding our way towards Christmas very gently. Now, yesterday I was approached, independently I was approached by a couple of trustees who said, "Cool, you guys have been working really, really hard this year. It's been very, very busy. Why don't you have a couple more days off?" And I've acquiesced. I wasn't pushed too hard, I have to say. So we have decided, therefore, that actually we're not going to open on the 22nd or 23rd of December either. So we've got 2 full weeks off. Now, I mean, this year, as you'll know, has been a tremendously busy year. What with our 15th anniversary, and then the whole change of name, and then there's been all sorts of other projects going on in the background. We're putting in a new database and various other very big bits of work, you know, getting the new minibus all sorted, all various things that have taken up a lot of people's time and energy, and our staff have and volunteers have put in a huge amount of extra effort over this year. And because of the way Christmas falls, we thought this year actually we would have a good couple of weeks off. So anything. Groups that happen on the Monday and Tuesday, those are now cancelled as the centre will not be open. We will, if you're unsure about that, feel free to give us a call. I know that people do miss coming into the groups over Christmas, but you know the staff really do need a very good rest this year. If only a few of us take time off, then the others have to step up, and it's a lot of extra effort as well for them. Now, of course, next week, therefore, it'll be the last outlook before the new year, but it also will be the time when we draw our Christmas raffle, and you can still get tickets. They've been going really, really well. That hamper, I'm pleased to say, has been attracting an awful lot of admiring looks. I know how much is in there. Actually, there's more than you can see from the top, but there's lots of good, lovely chocolatey and alcoholic treats and various other things in there that are definitely worth a candle. So this time next week we will be drawing the winning tickets, and if you have won, actually you will know before you get this recording through the post, unless you're very assiduous and listen on the as a podcast on a smart speaker. So there we are. So I will do a little review of the year next year, I think, about what the charity has been up to and how things have changed for us, and just so everybody gets an idea of why we feel we need a bit of extra time off a bit more. So anyway, if anybody's got any questions, for always we're available here on 024 7671 7522, you can give us a call at any time, and we will be back in the saddle in the new year on the 5th of January. Yep. Okay.
That's lovely.
And it's lovely to see Ro here. Yes. So Ro, as many people will know, volunteers in other parts of the charity, so it's great to have her in this part for a bit.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's lovely. Right, I'm going to go and buy my Christmas raffle tickets.
Good.
Okay, and I don't think any of us would get you an extra copy. Thank you very much.
Now here's Sarah with the sport.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. Now, I'm going to change with tradition this week. I'm going to start with Formula One. You know, the very fast brum-brums. Because unless you've been in a cave in Outer Mongolia, you'll know that something rather amazing happened yesterday. It was the final race of the whole year's series in Abu Dhabi. And it was a strange race because it began in daylight but finished in the dark. I don't know. And going into the race, as I told you last week, any one of three drivers could win the championship. Max Verstappen, the current champion. Oscar Piastri, the young, and he is young, I think he's only 23, Australian. Or Britain's Lando Norris. And Lando, who was leading going into this final race, knew that he actually only had to finish third in order to claim the championship, regardless of where the other two finished. So that must have been quite reassuring. Anyway, on the grid, Lando was second, but that didn't last long, and he was soon overtaken by his teammate Oscar Piastri. Then he had to go out to change his tyres, got caught up by the back markers, and had an overtake which was looked at by the stewards. Apparently his team didn't actually tell him that. Then, a bit later, he had another tyre change, and Max Verstappen's teammate, whose name I don't know and don't care about, actually was blocking Lando and so that the other two could get further ahead. Well, I say he was blocking. He was until he was told off by the stewards and had to let Lando pass. So, how did it finish? Well, the winner was Max Verstappen, of the Grand Prix, that is. Second in the Grand Prix was Oscar Piastri. But third was Britain's Lando Norris. Yes, he is the world champion, the 35th world champion, and the 11th for Britain. And as he emerged out of the final tunnel before the finish line, you could see that he had tears streaming down his face. And at that point, I'm afraid I totally lost it as well. And one final remark. He genuinely seems a nice man. Even the commentators were remarking on what a lovely man he is. Long may it carry on, Lando. We need more nice men in sport. Total change of sport now, and back to where I usually start, with football. Well, one day last week, can't even remember if it was Thursday or Friday, I sat down to watch the draw for the Men's World Cup, which starts in June in the USA, Mexico and Canada. And my gosh, you could tell the USA were involved. It was really razzmatazz. I'm not allowed to say anything about President Trump, because I don't want to be political, but he was there. So what happened? Well, in a nutshell, there were 48 teams going to the World Cup this year, well, next year now, which is the biggest number ever there. But it did mean a very long, protracted draw. The countries are divided into 12 groups, and there was a limit on the number of groups you could have from each what is called confederation. So a limit to the amount of Europeans, a limit to the amount of Asian, etc., etc. So the draw got very protracted and hard to follow by the end for those of us of a lesser brain. So who did we get? Well, two of our teams, our countries, as you know, have already qualified. So England drew Croatia, Panama and Ghana. I say Croatia like that because although they're actually one of my favourite countries, they beat us, you may recall, in the semi-final in 2018 at the Russian World Cup. And our other qualifier, Scotland, they drew Morocco, Haiti, and their first match will be against a little country called Brazil. Oh well, Scotland, onwards and upwards. Now, I want to correct something I said last week, because I said I was hoping we'd have five teams there, and I said both Wales and Northern Ireland, as well as the Republic of Ireland. But both Wales and Northern Ireland can't qualify. One of them can, but they are drawn in the same final qualification group, so could face each other if they both get through their first round. So coming down to the championship. Coventry City travelled eastwards to Ipswich and, in a nutshell, we lost. Was I disappointed? A tinge. Was I surprised? Not at all, unlike our other loss of the season against Wrexham, where I was both disappointed and it was unexpected. So why was I not surprised that we lost to Ipswich? Well, last season they were in the Premiership, only relegated at the end of the season. So they are still benefiting from the multi-million pound, what's called parachute payment, to allow them to keep many of their Premier players. In fact, the commentator did say that their defence was worth £100 million. Well, I mean, normal teams just can't compete. And we are still, well, we were without three of our key players, whose names I'm sure you'll recognise. Tak Sakamoto is still out with concussion, or recovering from concussion. Brandon Thomas Asante will be out for at least another 5 weeks. And Victor Torp seems to have been taken poorly when he was after he travelled to Ipswich. What made it worse, and was really the contentious talking point, was that early on in the first half, two players were booked. One of their players, I think that was for a straightforward foul, and one of our players, Josh Eccles, who just kicked the ball away petulantly after the whistle had blown. Well, I don't know if it was petulantly, but anyway, he kicked the ball away after the whistle had blown, which is an automatic yellow card. However, when their player, who'd already been booked, also kicked the ball away after the whistle had blown, he got away absolutely scot-free. He should have received another yellow card. Two yellows equal a red, and it would have been bye-bye Ipswich player. Anyway, we lost, and it did make it worse that they scored their final goal in extra time, when we were already 2-0 down. 3-0 does not reflect the match, which was pretty much 48% City, 52% Ipswich. And it's not just me that's saying that. Most commentators were commenting on that as well. But never mind, because we're still top of the league by 7 points ahead of Middlesbrough, and our goal difference took a slight dent, but it's now still 29, whereas Middlesbrough have a paltry goal difference of 8. Now, City will already have played by the time you're listening to this, because on Tuesday we travel to our real bogey ground of Preston North End, where we have apparently never won. But don't worry, folks, I will bring you all the gory details next week. What more could you want in the final programme before Christmas? Anyway, next Saturday, that's the 13th, we are at home to Bristol City, and it's a 3 p.m. kickoff. For those of you like me who will be listening on CWR. Now, moving to our non-league teams, Stratford Town travelled away to Bromsgrove and came back with a 2-1 victory. Stratford, of course, are in Tier 7. I don't have any news on Leamington in Tier 6, so I'm assuming they weren't playing, but I want to give a big congratulations to Coventry United, who are down in Tier 9, the bottom of the football pyramid, who are in to the fourth round draw for the FA Vars. Well done, Coventry, you're doing us good. Also flying the flag for the city this week were Coventry Rugby Club. Our Cov lads hosted London Scottish and thrash them 61 points to 10. At one stage, they apparently scored 3 tries in 4 minutes. It's a wonder I couldn't hear the seismic shakes nearby where I live, as all the COS supporters jumped up and down. Coming down with a bump, the Ashes. Well, the cricket continued with the second of the Ashes series in Australia. All I'm going to say is, on the good side, it lasted just over the 4 days into the 5 days, as it's meant to. England lost, and only one of the England batsmen bothered to show up. So well done, Joe Root. But I don't think the team need worry about booking extra hand luggage on their flight home, because they won't be bringing them Ashes. Not actually that the Ashes themselves ever leave England. And finally, now I teased you last week with talking about December the 18th, 7 p.m. on BBC One. And it is, of course, Sports Personality of the Year, my favourite show of the whole year. Now, at time of speaking, which is early-ish Monday afternoon, the BBC still haven't announced the final list of their nominations for the overall award. But let's be honest, when you just had a world champion in one of the leading world sports, whether you say it's the car, not the driver, nah, it's a bit of both. I suspect by a country mile our Lando Norris will be walking away with it. And I would love to see Hannah Hampton get the second or third. She was the goalie at the Women's Euros, and she's the lass who lives with a visual impairment, which has mostly been corrected. But she's been so great talking about her visual impairment with the press. Anyway, looking into the reality of things, I've just checked the website, and top of the bookies list is Rory McIlroy, the golfer. Yeah, I know he won the US Masters, and he was quite instrumental in us winning the Ryder Cup. But then I'm amazed to see that in second place is Chloe Kelly, the woman who kicked the final penalty. Sorry, Chloe. Great footballer, but you ain't no personality. And they've only got Lando in third. Although when I looked at the small print, it did say last updated 4 days ago. Yes, well, Lando has kind of won a world championship in between. But I'll bring you the final list and the other categories next week. So I hope you've enjoyed sport and you've enjoyed seeing all the celebrations for Lando Norris. And I hope you have a great week ahead. Bye!
Sports Personality of the Year. Well, Lando certainly gets my vote. Now here's Dave with this week's postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there. Welcome to your postbag. Well, Christmas is creeping up on us again, and next week is our Christmas edition of Outlook. So you must send in your Christmas messages now, so I have a chance of putting them in for next week, otherwise they'll wait till the new year. So let's make it a festive, caring postbag. Most of us have left messages and answer phones, so it's not a big task. Just ring up the Resource Centre on 024 76 717 522 and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper. We can remove any hesitations and mistakes. And I will read out any cards, so you can ring me if you want on 024 76 598 484. If I'm not in, just leave your name and phone number and I'll get back to you. You can email me at davidmonks46@gmail.com. The first message is from folk singer Lauren South, who's got a message for Amy, who went to one of her gigs.
Hi Amy, it's Lauren South here, just saying a quick hello and hope everything's well with you, and hopefully see you at a gig somewhere soon. Take care, bye.
First message from a listener is from Graham Whale. The news of the senseless chopping down of the sycamore tree in a gap in Hadrian's Wall and the subsequent planting of seedlings from it, including in Coventry, reminded him of a book by L.J. Ross called The Sycamore Gap.
Interested to hear the item about the sycamore tree and the saplings being planted in Coventry. I actually, well, a year or two back, read a book called Sycamore Gap, written by L.J. Ross. It was a fictional book, not necessarily about the sycamore tree, but about human remains being found in the wall close to the tree. It is one of the three books in the trilogy so far, the D.I. Ryan series. Book one is Holy Island, book two is Sycamore Gap, and book three is Heavenfield, which I've yet to read. There is a cult undercurrent through the series in which the chief constable is involved, though only the reader knows that so far. So yes, it's called Sycamore Gap, and it's by L.J. Ross.
Thank you, Graham. Have you read any good books lately? Well, over the last 2 weeks, there's been the biography of Coventry-born Jack Reacher thriller writer Lee Child. Well, you being a postbagger will know that a scoop interview by me with Lee Child went out in Postbag the week before, where he told you that his books have been transcribed by computer into Morse code for former radio operators of the American Marine Corps that have since become blind. We're impressed by that. Former editor of the Talking Newspaper, Jill Smith, was, who phoned me up to keep in touch. Sheila and I were friends with her mum and dad. Jill sends her best wishes for Christmas. Robert Franklin's been phoning me up when I've been going somewhere jolly exciting, waiting for a plane at Glasgow Airport or on the train going to various places, which is really nice, and I phoned him back later for a chat. Robert says that since giving a talk at the Monday Club, he's become a bit of a celebrity. He was recently interviewed on R&IB Connect Radio, which is on the Freeview, on the television, etc. He talked about the help he has on his train journeys to Devon with Journey Care, which has been telling about in Postbag, which is great. And he tells you about dog therapy that's been taking place with Coventry, with Warwickshire Vision and also Leamington. So, do you find dogs therapeutic? Give us your doggy memories. And he's been interviewed on Rugby Hospital Radio. Robert reminded me of listener Chris Wade, who's a presenter with Coventry Hospital Radio. And it was nice to meet Bernice at the Winter Warmer, and she tells you how important Coventry Vision Hub is to visually impaired people like herself.
Without this centre, I think, this is my opinion though, David.
That's brilliant.
Without this centre, the people that has sight lost in Coventry, they wouldn't have, you know, place like this to go to meet friends and have beautiful activities, you know. So I think it's lovely.
Bernice goes to the Monday Club and so does Elizabeth. Elizabeth gives you this report on a visit from Emily of the D-Day Darlings and her mum, musical singer Elizabeth.
Hi everyone, the weekly report. Hot on the heels of her phenomenal success on Simon Cowell's Britain's Got Talent, we were honoured with the presence of the luscious Emily of the D-Day Darlings and her mum, Elizabeth. This was at the Monday Club. What a lovely morning. We all joined in with festive carols. Not to be outdone, our very own Dave sang a beautiful duet with Emily as a finale. Thank you, David, for a super morning.
No more talk of darkness. Forget these wild-eyed fears. I'm here, nothing can harm you. My words will warm and calm you. Let me be your freedom. Let daylight dry your tears. I'm here with you, beside you, to guard you and to guide you.
I certainly did. Well, it's our Christmas edition of Outlook next week. Please don't let me down and send in some Christmas greetings or anything Christmassy. So, ring Coventry Vision Hub on 02476 717 522 and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper and leave a message. You can ring me if you want on 02476 598 484. And either leave a message or leave your name and phone number and I'll get back to you if I'm not in. Or send me an email on davidmonks46@gmail.com or a Christmas card to the studio. Any way you like, but you need to send a message in right now so I can get it ready for the Christmas edition of Postbag next week. So send in your memories of Christmas past. Join us next week. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
Thank you, Dave, for this week's Postbag. Now, here's Elaine to tell us all about the village of Paylington.
Paylington, it used to be. The records of the village and its families go back to the days when Danes and Saxons lived in close proximity, if not in complete amity. It is set in beautiful country, an agricultural area, where life is perhaps not so rushed as in a town. Over the centuries, the village lands have been divided into various areas and belong to various lords of the manor. Family names going back many years are still found there. Buswell, Bailey, Harrison, Skipworth, and of course the Earls of Denbigh. These names are all on a map dated 1762, which was based on the Pailton Enclosure Award. Some land was owned by Trinity College, Cambridge, and it held the leasehold and right to collect tithes for a fixed rent from the tenants. His church, dedicated to St. Denis, built in 1884, and had a major overhaul in 1982 because of the presence of dry rot. Pailton Hall, in the centre of the village, was left by Lady Mary Fielding, the twin sister of the Earl of Denbigh, to the Archdeacon of Coventry, and the Vicar of Monk's Kirby, for the benefit of respectable inhabitants of the parish of Monk's Kirby. The income at her death went towards the salary of the curate of the parish. Eventually, five trustees were appointed to administer the income and the property. They were responsible to the charity commissioners, but the hall was sold in 1986. Over the years, the village has changed, of course. The school was bombed during the Second World War and not rebuilt. Since then, the school children have always travelled by bus to the schools in Monk's Kirby. The old village hall became a private house, and to replace it, the Mission Hall in Lutterworth Road was purchased as the new village hall. A few new houses have been built within the village boundaries, older houses have been modernised, and incomers have come to the village to make a friendly, caring community. It had a thriving pub where various village gatherings were held, and a village shop, which had been in the same hands since 1969. A thriving coach business started from small beginnings by Harry Lewis with a brough and a dog cart in 1907. He charged 5 and 6 pence to Rugby Station and 3 shillings to Brinklow Station. Today his grandson Norman has enlarged the business greatly, and it is possible to board a luxurious coach in the village and be transported to various parts of Europe and be returned to one's own doorstep. At the centre of the village, where 3 roads meet, from Coventry, Rugby and Lutterworth, there used to be a village pump and war memorial, but, alas, the pump has disappeared. The village used to have its own bakehouse, and it was a great pleasure in the early morning to collect hot bread and watch the dough being put into the baking oven with its glowing fire underneath, and when cooked, taken out with the long-handled shovel. Modernisation and big firms took over, and all that remains now is the name, the Bakehouse. Pailton Radio Station was established by the RAF in 1940. 1946 saw it taken over by the Ministry of Civil Aviation. Sputnik 1, the first Earth satellite, was heard there in October 1957. Since 1946, the buildings have been extended considerably, and the number of staff employed has increased.
Thanks, Elaine. I once had a puncture driving through Pailton and it was pouring down with rain, so I haven't got great memories of it. Now here's Sue with the second part of Canine Heroes, about dogs who are trained to be medical dogs. This is taken from the I newspaper and is written by Joanna Whitehead.
When it comes to assistance alert dogs, however, it takes around 2 years, and breed-wise, it's more of a mixed bag. We've got everything from poodles to vizslas, labradoodles to a Yorkie poo. We recently welcomed our first Staffy to the team, which we're very pleased about. Both disease detection dogs and assistance alert dogs undergo a rigorous training program involving early scent training. Dogs are directed towards a line of 4 stands with small containers on the end, each of which contains a urine sample. As the training progresses, the sample is progressively reduced, so the game gets harder for the dogs. Every sniff is logged, and the dogs are rewarded with treats and plenty of love and attention. The dogs sniff each container, and when they find the odour they're looking for, they stop in front of it, says Butlin, a behaviour known as an indication. These vary from dog to dog. Some of them will nudge it, she continues. Some of them will stand dead in front of it. Some of them will sit. And then they get a treat reward when the computer confirms that it's the right one. For them, it's all a game. The team also does blank runs. Sometimes we'll put four samples out and none of them contain the odour. We want the dogs to tell us that, she says. Bear in mind that a lot of patients who provide the samples have other diseases as well. So the dogs are learning to detect a specific disease amongst several others, which I think makes it even more incredible. Training for a medical detection dog isn't cheap or quick work, however. We are a charity, says Butlin. If we train a dog and give it to a client, it takes around 2 years and costs around £30,000 per dog. They also work with what they call applicant-owned dogs, standard pets whose owners notice that their sniffing skills are particularly sophisticated. We'd received so many inquiries from people with a health condition who noticed that before they became unwell, their dogs started to act differently, says Butlin. If they're already doing this intuitively, we can work with those clients. Obviously, there are lots of hoops to jump through. We need to assess the severity of their condition and the impact we think the dogs can make. A lot of work goes into it. It's not straightforward. For a charity that recognises the profound value of dogs, it's no surprise that the welfare of the animals they work with is taken extremely seriously. Whether dogs arrive as puppies or are brought in by members of the public, they operate a strict no-kennel policy, meaning all the dogs they work with live in family homes as people's pets, where they're loved and cared for. While the prospect of having a dog trained to sniff out cancer in every hospital or GP surgery might sound like a radical, potentially exciting development, the scalability and resources required simply do not permit this. Too many people have got cancer, and I'm not sure we'd ever be able to train enough dogs to do that. But we believe they can make some really vital contributions to technology, says Butlin. The focus, therefore, is very much on research and development, and the possible creation of some sort of e-nose that's able to replicate what the dogs are capable of doing. The team are deploying dogs in real-world settings, however. We've just started a UTI detection project, says Butlin. UTIs are one of the most common infections among older people and can become life-threatening if untreated. This will hopefully involve dogs going into care homes or rehabilitation centres where people are very vulnerable and susceptible to UTIs, but perhaps unable to communicate that they're not feeling very well, she says. In this scenario, dogs would passively screen, similarly to how you might see a drug detection dog at the airport. They wouldn't touch the people, but they might be gently sniffing around. People keen to help are welcome to make a donation, sponsor a puppy, fundraise, or volunteer with the charity. At the moment, a lot of the money we raise is going towards getting the bowel cancer detection dogs to do the double-blind testing phase and preparing our data for publication, which is when scientists and medics will start to take notice, says Butlin. Research suggests that all diseases produce a change in odour in our bodies, meaning the potential for dogs to sniff out all kinds of disease is huge. At a time when cancer research has warned of delays to research into cancers due to soaring visa fees and immigration restrictions faced by international researchers, our homegrown canine companions may well have an indispensable role to play. And they have a website, which is medicaldetectiondogs.org.uk.
Now, a man who thought he could fly. This is written and read by Pete. I wonder if his plans ever got off the ground.
It took 20 brawny men to hold the eagle on the ground as a gusty autumn wind whipped across the cricket ground. The giant balloon rolled and swung on its tethers, threatening to crush the aeronaut who crouched beneath it, making last-minute adjustments to the network of ropes and straps. He looked nervous, observers reported. And well he might, for it was only the second time that George Higgins had attempted the crazily dangerous feat of parachuting from a high-flying balloon. His first descent, before a crowd of 70,000 in London, had almost ended in disaster when he tumbled head over heels for a few moments after leaving the balloon. And now, at Coventry, on a day of wind and rainy squalls, he'd pledged to fly again, whatever the weather. Courage was not a quality that 34-year-old Higgins lacked, and neither was self-belief. He called himself Professor, although in reality he was a coachman in private service in London, and for several years he'd been trying to unlock the secrets of a safe descent. His experiments had begun at his home in Clapham, with a ladder and a large umbrella of the type used to protect passengers travelling in open horse-drawn coaches. But by November 1888, he was using a parachute made of cotton stretched over a cage of light wooden hoops. The contraption was simply attached to the balloon. There was no basket for him to ride in, and the idea was that at the right moment he simply cast himself adrift and floated gently to the ground. As he made the final preparations for that second flight, Higgins was presented with a new device to take with him, an altitude indicator, which he placed in his breast pocket. Then, watched by a crowd of less than 1,000, the last constraints were removed and the balloon rose swiftly away from the Butts cricket ground, gaining height rapidly over Spon End. Higgins was a tiny figure suspended beneath it when he let go, and for a long second or two, his parachute failed to open. The guy ropes twisted. Showing extraordinary presence of mind, the aeronaut calmly untwisted them as the ground rushed towards him. He landed in some allotments alongside the railway line in Spon End, twisting at the last moment to avoid a hedge and falling heavily onto his side. Higgins claimed he'd reached 2,700 feet, though the altitude meter read 1,500. And buoyed by the cheers and no doubt his own profound sense of relief, announced that he intended to return one day and make another flight in Coventry. It was not to be. 18 months later at Croydon, he had a miraculous escape when his parachute failed to detach and he disappeared into the clouds, apparently unable to free himself or bring the balloon back to earth. His assistants feared him lost, but astonishingly received a telegram from him 3 hours later, postmarked Kent. He'd finally managed to land the balloon after clambering up the net encasing it and releasing gas from the top. He reckoned he'd reached a height of 5 miles and claimed there were icicles on his moustache to prove it. In August 1891, his luck finally ran out. As he prepared to make another flight at Kirkstall, near Leeds, the balloon suddenly lifted off the ground and struck some telegraph wires, throwing him to the ground. He broke his back and expired within 15 minutes. Just one more casualty of a growing obsession with flight.
Thanks, Pete. Now here's Nigel with a short update on the redevelopment of Spon End.
The latest chapter in the saga over the redevelopment of the Spon End estate has been completed. First mooted in 2019, the proposals have now received planning permission from the City Council. Housing Association Citizen and the Hill Group are already well advanced on the demolition of Kerry House, Milestone House and Trafalgar House as part of the first stage of the redevelopment of Swan End Estate. This work commenced in May. Coventry Society has supported the redevelopment of the area since 2019. But we have, firstly, expressed concern of the lack of education and health provision as the number of homes is significantly increased. Secondly, we want to ensure that the local heritage is protected as part of the neighbourhood is within or adjacent to conservation areas. Thirdly, in line with our theme for 2025 of improving the River Sherborne, we wish to see measures implemented to improve open space provision and enhance the river setting. Coventry City Council's Planning Committee approved plans for the future of the Swan End Estate on the 16th of October. The regeneration scheme will see 700 new homes built by Citizen Housing, the successor to Whitefriars Housing, which took over the city's council housing in the early 2000s. The redevelopment will be spread over three phases, with work on the first likely to start in March next year, with the final phase aimed to be completed by 2035. The first phase will see 257 apartments built in four separate blocks. These will be one and two bedroom units, 100% affordable, with two of the blocks featuring commercial premises on the ground floor. The second phase will see a further 462 one, two and three bedroom apartments built, a quarter of which will be affordable, while the final phase will see 27 two, three and four bedroom houses built. There was considerable debate at Planning Committee. A number of councillors raised concerns over a shortage of parking spaces. The length of time to complete the scheme, over 10 years, was a worry. Others highlighted the issues that we have previously raised, such as local facilities and improving the River Sherborne. Nevertheless, the planning application was approved with conditions including negotiating a planning agreement with Citizen. This could amount to over £5 million in addition to the overall demolition and redevelopment costs of £125 million. This extra money will be used, for example, to provide the necessary additional school spaces, places and health facilities as well as open space provision. Councillor Say Agbola, a member of the Planning Committee, summed up the benefits, stating that the scheme would breathe new life into the area, support local shops and businesses, and make it safer and more attractive. He also said, "This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to revitalise one of our city's most historic and important neighbourhoods. Furthermore, it will generate construction jobs, support the local economy and help meet our housing targets." Finally, he commented, "We have a fantastic opportunity to transform Swan End by delivering affordable housing, greener public spaces and a stronger community."
Thank you, Nigel. Now the first part of God Bless Us Everyone. Amanda Hodges considers a Christmas carol. This is taken from This England and is read by Elaine.
Reflect upon your present blessings, of which every man has many, not on your past misfortunes, of which all men have some. A wise sentiment to consider as the festive season approaches, taken from Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, his beloved novella, which, in many ways, re-establish the popular conception of Christmas as we know it today. By the autumn of 1843, Dickens was a man in a real quandary. An established and charismatic young writer of great renown, after the publication of five novels, including The Pickwick Papers and Oliver Twist, he was unhappy with the lukewarm reception for his latest novel, Martin Chuzzlewit, which came out in serialised form, and was thinking over an idea which would soon come to successful literary fruition. the effervescent, colourfully attired Dickens had established a reputation as a writer of strong social conscience, the champion of the dispossessed, impoverished and ignored, as so much of his work was motivated by the desire to improve the lives of poor people otherwise overlooked by society. Such motivation had its roots in his own childhood, during the miserable period when his father was sent to debtors' prison, and young Charles lived in separate lodgings and had spent months unhappily labelling items in a blacking factory. In the midst of such a lonely, bewildering time, he began as a boy his lifelong habit of walking the streets of London, prematurely exposed to the seamier side of life, witnessing violence, alcoholism, and sheer human deprivation, things which would forever remain painfully etched into his memory. His earlier novel, Oliver Twist, had exposed the plight of London workhouses, and Nicholas Nickleby proved pivotal in closing the infamous Yorkshire schools where unwanted children were badly treated, as the case of the fictional Smike and unscrupulous abusive Squeers evinced. The idea of a book specifically drawing attention to the plight of impoverished children had been germinating for a while in Dickens' fertile imagination, but he had originally thought of it as a political pamphlet. His indignation aroused by reading government reports of the dire conditions surrounding the work undertaken by poor children, often unregulated and inherently exploitive. He had visited a ragged school, which was a charity school giving free education to the poorest, and had seen firsthand the awful conditions in which many children lived. Invited to Manchester, where his beloved sister Fanny lived, he saw that the effects of the Industrial Revolution were keenly enhancing poverty. Dickens gave a lecture to an organisation promoting education for working men and women, and returned home with a heightened awareness of what he must do. It was ignorance that most worried him. In the Examiner weekly paper, he wrote at the time, "Side by side with crime, disease and misery in England, ignorance is always brooding and certain to be found." Although it is Ebenezer Scrooge's redemption that commands our attention, and Tiny Tim who warms the heart, many forget that, from Dickens' perspective anyway, at the heart of A Christmas Carol are actually the two sad figures of ignorance and want, hidden under the cloak of the ghost of Christmas present. When this ghost shows the slowly repenting Scrooge these haunting children, Scrooge asks, "Have they no refuge or resource?" And the spirit memorably answers by quoting Scrooge's own words back to him. "Are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses?" Dickens was famous for his habit of taking extremely long walks, and he reported at the time that he'd composed the story in his head, weeping and laughing and then crying again as he conjured the captivating tale of Scrooge walking his familiar black streets of London many a night when all the sober folks had gone to bed. Into the story of miserly Ebenezer Scrooge, who learns the power of redemption one long Christmas Eve after visitations from three ghosts, Dickens poured his own childhood memories of Camden Town, where the clerk Bob Cratchit resides, and perhaps his sister Fanny's crippled young son inspired Tiny Tim. All was seasoned with the sympathy of an adult for his younger, more vulnerable childhood self.
Dave's back now with his report on this year's winter warmer.
Hello there and welcome to Coventry Vision Hub for their winter warmer. I'm with my neighbour Kevin, so are you looking forward to looking around and enjoying the winter warmer, Kevin?
Yes, I am, David. Yes, very much so.
I'm talking to the waitress who is serving us cups of tea. So what's your name?
My name's Ruth, and I'm ruthless.
Why did the one-handed man cross the road?
Why did the one-handed man cross the road?
To get to the second-hand shop.
Wow, like it. I am speaking to another waitress now. What's your name?
My name is Jenny.
And so how long have you been a volunteer with Coventry Vision Hub?
Oh, probably a couple of years, but really what happened was Chris Norman, who is my friend, made me walk the Coventry Way with him at the beginning of this year in April, so we did the 40 miles together.
Wow.
And now I'm just here all the time and I really love it.
Thanks a lot. And you're taking the orders for something to eat in the cafe. Yeah.
I am, yep. We've got a really nice selection today. We've got pork and stuffing batches, we've got two different types of soups, we've got cake, and I made one of the cakes.
Wonderful. So, with Rosie, who's one of the saviours of the resource centre, she, before she died, she wanted a cafe here called Rosie's Cozy Cafe. And I see on the notice board there's a Rosie's, this is Rosie's Cozy Cafe, which is nice.
It would be lovely to make this permanent, wouldn't it?
It would, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe a plan for the future. That would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jenny. Thank you. Oh, great. I'm talking to Chris now. Chris Norman. So how's it going?
Well, it's organised chaos, but everyone's happy. So that's what matters, isn't it, really?
Absolutely. I mean, he had a laugh and a joke from the word go in here. It's fantastic.
Brilliant. It really is.
Not that I was here at the word go, because I was late.
Have you been to any Christmas parties yet?
No. I don't have any friends to invite me to Christmas parties, Dave. No, we're trying to organise some stuff, but Claire's going to Poland next week, so we're a little bit busy getting ready for that. And
you're going to Poland?
I'm not going to Poland, no, I'm staying behind, but Claire is going to Poland.
Oh, she is, that's for the showdown.
Yeah, for the showdown again.
That's going really well, isn't it?
Oh, she's doing brilliant, yeah.
She's really brilliant.
She's doing great. Yeah. We're a competition of the weekend, and won a load of games, so it was great.
Great stuff. I like the reindeer antlers on the head, by the way.
I find them insanely distracting. Every time I move, they jingle, and it just seems to rattle the thoughts right out of my bonts.
There you are. Okay. Well, you're doing a great job here. Thank you.
Cheers. Merry Christmas to all the listeners.
Merry Christmas to you. God bless every one of us. I'm in the Mary Beale room now, and I'm speaking to Sarah. Okay, you're a volunteer here, right?
Yes, I am a volunteer. I work for Coventry Vision Hub, yes.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm a leader of the craft group.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And you've got some lovely examples of the crafts here, haven't you? So can you describe what crafts you've got in here, please?
Okay, so we've got things that the craft group and other people connected to Coventry Vision Hub have made for us, knitting. We've got some poured paintings by Joe Dickey. We've got some Christmas decorations and some Halloween decorations made by my craft group. And we've got some Christmas trees made out of corks by the craft group. And yeah, we've got loads of Christmas cards we've got as well. And then coming on from that, we've got Tombola. That's another group of people that are doing Tombola. Then we've got cakes, jams and pickles. And then we've got Karen's stall, which has got some handmade crafts on there.
Dave, hello, nice to meet you again. I helped organise and money-wise for Judith and the Coventry Macular Support Group.
Yeah, it's an absolutely wonderful group and a great help for people with macular degeneration, isn't it?
Yeah, the group are lovely. There's some really, really lovely people that attend, and the information that they get, both from Judith and the rest of the people that go, the useful tips and hints, I'd like to think are helpful for them, yeah.
So when do they remind me, the Macular Support Group,
yeah,
is
Yeah, Coventry Macular Support Group, and it's on a Tuesday. It's the third Tuesday of every month, and we meet at Bonds Hospital, which is on Hill Street. If you've not been before, please come along. We'd love to see you. We're now not meeting until the new year.
Yeah.
So 2026 in January. We look forward to seeing you if you haven't been already.
OK, what time does it start and finish?
About 10:30. If you could be there for 10:30, please.
Bernice, I'm speaking to Bernice of the Monday Club. So, are you on a stall?
Yes, I am. I am on a stall. I'm on this stall right here where we sell the best coffee. Best coffee.
Yeah.
Not cheap.
No.
But it's worth buying. It's a beautiful coffee. So I'm doing coffee and I'm doing mince pies.
Yeah, well.
And baby chocolates for the kiddies.
Well, excellent.
I'm enjoying the day.
I'm speaking to Bijan, who's been helping here at the Winter Warmer, haven't you? And you've been serving the cafe?
I have. So I've been doing the tea and coffee.
Okay, and you help with the walks on Tuesday and Wednesday around the Memorial Park.
I do. So, and I've been helping out with the walks around Warmer Park for a year and a half, 2 years. So I really enjoy helping out, and it's one of my favourite things to do when I'm not working.
The walks start from Coventry Vision Hub, don't they, on a Tuesday and Wednesday? Yeah.
Yes, I do. So,
what time does it start off?
So the Tuesday starts off from 11 till 1.
Yeah.
And on the Wednesday it starts from 10 till 12.
Is it? Okay. Here we are. I'm speaking to Tina now. Okay. So we've got a greeting for our listeners, please, Tina.
Wish everybody a happy Christmas, the new year, and may it be a good one.
Wonderful. Thank you, Tina.
Hopefully.
Thank you. Here we are. Well, with the sound of Earlston Primary School, we say cheerio from the Winter Warmer at the Coventry Vision Hub. Bye for now.
And that report brings us to the end of this week's Outlook. So from me, Ashley Hayward, and the rest of the team, it's goodbye for another week.